I have a book at home that's called The Hardest Sermons You'll Ever Have to Preach. And in it, various preachers have been asked to send in the sermon that they found most difficult to deliver. And so a pastor from New York shared his sermon after 9/11. Another shared a sermon after a church member had committed suicide. Another after a newborn infant died straight after birth. And on such occasions, the words that the preacher gives carry a particular weight, don't they? And many of you have told me, it was slightly before my time, but of Paul going through Job straight after his cancer diagnosis, and how the experiences he went through seemed to add extra weight to those sermons in that particular book. Well, tonight we start the book that is the hardest sermon that Joel ever had to preach. His congregation had been devastated by locust swarms. Food stores are decimated. Sacrifices at the temple are temporarily cancelled. And somewhere in Judah, perhaps in Jerusalem itself, Joel gets up to speak. He looks out at his congregation. There's a priest who's been twiddling his fingers all week because he's not got anything to do. There's the farmer with six wailing kids who haven't eaten most of the days this week. There's the widow mourning the loss of her husband. And he comes and he stands and says, "The word of the Lord that came to Joel, son of Pethuel. This is the word that God gave to me in this situation." Now, I hope I'm not cursing anything, but I'm pretty certain we're not going to face a plague of locusts at any point in our lifetime. But that's not the point. We learn here how to face trials, particularly community-wide trials, trials that have different impacts on different kinds of people. There are many community-wide trials at the moment, aren't they? Perhaps an influx of refugees from a war-torn nation, perhaps a national famine or a pandemic or a drought, perhaps a local tragedy like the loss of a person under terrible circumstances. We may never face locusts, but there may be a variety of trials we go through. God gave this word to Joel. It wasn't just Joel's idea, it was God's literal words. And it wasn't meant just for Joel's audience, but for all those who suffer. All those communities of believers who suffer in strange times. So what do we learn about times of trial from this passage? Well, we learn two things. Firstly, we learn, let suffering make you weep. And we see that in verses 2 to 12. Let suffering make you weep. Let's look again at the suffering they experienced. We're told that there wasn't just one locust swarm, but in verse 4 we see there's actually four locust swarms that come. So the exact phrases and how they're translated in different Bibles is not really that important. I'll explain why in a second. But notice that there are four waves here. What the locust swarm has left, the great locusts have eaten. And what the great locusts have left, the young locusts have eaten. And what the young locusts have left, other locusts have eaten. When I was looking into locusts, I did what I rarely do and had a bit of a YouTube search to find out about locust swarms at the moment. And I watched a video about locust swarms in Kenya. And that explained that locusts start as hoppers. They just kind of hop from leaf to leaf until they get enough food till they're able to grow wings. And then they might fly off, go somewhere else. But they tend to fly with the wind, so there's a good chance the wind changes and they come back even larger. And communities that have a lot of locusts, they come up with different names for the different types of locusts. It's probably the same locust, or maybe two swarms joining together into some mega swarm. But that's what seems to be happening here. It starts with these bouncing little hoppers, the tiny locusts, and then they grow and they grow and they grow. And every little scrap that the community thinks they have is eventually decimated. The greatest swarms apparently can have several billion locusts and cover an area 40 miles wide. That's from here to Liverpool in a straight line. So you can imagine the immense devastation, not just to one small community, but to the whole nation. Now, in this video, the people from Kenya were explaining all the ramifications. Obviously, people were starving, but also violence was breaking out. Someone had a scrap of land, and if a rival cow came to eat from it. Guns could be drawn. And obviously theft increased. The whole society was falling apart. And Joel paints a very similar picture here. He shows the impact of the locust swarm on four sections of society. So firstly, in verses 2 to 4, he encourages the elders to reflect on this suffering. Now, you've got to remember, back then, people didn't have history books. So if you wanted to learn about the past, you spoke to the older men in your community who hopefully knew the story of older men before them. And Joel says to these older men, "Hear this, you elders. Listen, all who live in the land. Has anything like this ever happened in your days or in the days of your ancestors?" Well, the implied answer is no. This is an unprecedented locust swarm. So these old men have not heard a story beforehand about this kind of event. It's never happened before. And they're called to record it and pass it on to their children and their children's children and the children after that. This locust storm is greater than any that went before. Now, perhaps we can think of the fact that we've had a recent trial, haven't we? A recent stage of suffering that even the oldest among us probably don't remember the last kind of pandemic. Maybe there'd be more to come. Things that happened to us that haven't happened for generations. This should make us pause and reflect. And secondly, the drunkards reflect on the suffering. You might be surprised that the drunkards are called to reflect. But I think the focus of verses 5 to 7 is that even those who were given up to hedonism, to enjoying the world in the most sinful ways possible, the party that never stops has stopped in light of this judgment. If you go to the bar, there's only tap water. The grapes are all destroyed. The new wine is gone and the old wine is quickly disappearing. The locusts sweep like a great army through the land. They strip the great vintage bare. And sometimes God sends these community-wide events. And even the people who think they've got it all together, the people who think they're living for pleasure, suddenly realize that their pleasure is very short-lived. Further, the priests are called to reflect on the suffering. They're called to mourn like a virgin bride who was bereaved before her wedding day. Why are they to do that? Well, there's no grain, there's no drink offerings, so they can't do the normal functions of the temple. This means that apart from maybe the food sacrifices, and most of those would have stopped too, because they'd have been the only source of food for the community, the substantial part of God's worship has ceased. So this is the opposite end of the scale. You've got the drunkards on one end of the scale, the people who are trying to live without God in their lives, and then you've got the priests who are trying to maintain the worship of God, but both of them are destroyed. And again, we could think of times that God's worship has been hampered by things that have happened, and it should cause us to reflect. And then finally, the farmers reflect on suffering in verses 11 to 12. Now, you've got to remember, in those days, farmers weren't just the odd person in a group of like this, a congregation like this. The vast majority of people would have been farmers in that community. Even if they had other jobs on the side, they'd have had a plot of land to get food from. But their harvest is utterly destroyed. A week or so ago, it's much more minor, but we came back from our holidays and we went over to our vegetable box that many of you have seen. And there was this kale that was being grown and there were swarms of caterpillars who'd eaten all the way through it. So we had none left. But of course, we could go to the shops. We could buy more. Imagine that food is the source of income for your family. Imagine it's not just the source of income, it's the only food your family are ever likely to have. And it's not just one harvest. Look at verses 11 to 12. Grieve for the wheat, the barley. The harvest of the field is destroyed. The vine is dried up. The fig tree is withered. The pomegranate, the palm, the apple tree, all the trees of the field are dried up. Surely as a result, the people's joy is withered away. Doesn't matter if you varied your portfolio, you grew different kinds of crops. Every person would have been impacted by this event. So Joel has called them to think about these things. But when they reflect, what are they to do? Well, look at those words. Verse 5, "Wail, all you drinkers of wine." Or verse 8, mourn, grieve. Verse 11, despair, you farmers, wail, you vine growers, and grieve again. And then verse 12, perhaps summarizing it all right at the end there, surely the people's joy is withered away like the plants in their farm. Joel stands up to these people already burdened by these events, and he encourages them not to think on the bright side, but to look closely at the impact of these events. Now, as we go through Joel, we'll see the way that he goes from these events to the greater judgment, and then eventually to the good news at the end of the book. But he starts by being incredibly honest about the events that the community have been through. And here he gives a good example to us in times of suffering. The Bible never encourages us to downplay suffering. We saw in the Psalms recently, many of those songs discuss human pain. Famously, Jesus wept at the tomb of Lazarus. He was going to raise him up in 10 minutes' time. But he still wept, because this isn't the way the world is meant to be. We read in Romans 8 earlier on this year that the whole of creation, and Christians in particular, are to groan as they look at the effects of sin on the world. When we see the world is not as it should be, i.e. not as the Garden of Eden is, we're not to be like atheists who say, well, this kind of thing happens, it's just random chance in the universe. No, we're to weep, we're to wail that the world is not the way it should be. There's a temptation to skip this step, isn't there? But Joel says we are to wail, we are to mourn. And that maybe gives us a framework for many of the conversations we're having at the moment. As we start to open up our homes, I don't know about you, I'm starting to see people I've not seen for a year and a half. And everyone's got their own story of something discouraging and disappointing that happened. And you might be thinking, how can I be a Christian in that situation? So the other week I was meeting up with my family, and one of my cousin's sons, who's training to be a footballer, went out for his training at home. Obviously, he wasn't able to go to the football club. He went out in the snow, and under the snow there was a bottle. He slipped on it, and he gave himself an injury that he's still not recovered from. That might be the end of his career. That's just one story, and there's many others. As we went around that party, all my cousins, all of my aunties and uncles, they all had a story to tell. What's a Christian way to respond to that? Is it to say, look on the bright side? Well, there might be a case for that at times. But then, at the same time, the Bible tells us to be honest about events, to not lie and downplay them. But what about people who've come out of horrifying situations? Maybe waves of refugees coming into our country from Syria, Hong Kong, and other nations. Many people might not be quick in those situations to talk about their experiences. But if they do, what are we to say as Christians? We're to accept that the world is broken. We're to acknowledge the wrongness of locust swarms and pandemics and random chance accidents and terrible governments coming into control. We don't have to pull the wool over people's eyes. We can be honest. We can weep with those who weep. We can share stories of our own suffering. And by acknowledging that the world isn't as it should be, we're testifying to something very important in the Bible storyline. The world is fallen. The second thing that Joel encourages us to do, and it's worth saying that this sermon isn't going to cover everything that Joel would do, but the second thing we see here is let suffering make you lament. Let suffering make you lament. And we see that in verses 13 to 20. Now, I guess many of you would have been here over the summer when I and probably other preachers talked about what a psalm of lament is. But in case you didn't, you might know that there's various kinds of prayers. There's prayers of thanksgiving when we say thank you to God for all he's done. Prayers of confession when we confess our sin. Prayers of intercession when we pray for the needs of other people. Well, lots of Christians are unaware that one of the prayers that we can pray in certain situations is a prayer of lament. A prayer where we bring our suffering before God and present it before his throne. If something horrible happens, most of us feel that needs to unburden on someone. Maybe you'd call up your parents. Maybe you'd talk to your husband or wife. Maybe you'd get a best friend on the phone. You don't necessarily want them to solve it. You just unburden what has happened to them. Well, that's what happens here. Because this is a national event, it is organized, it is formal, but they are, as a community, bringing their suffering before God. Let's look at what that involves. Verse 13. Put on sackcloth, you priests, and mourn. Wail, you who minister before the altar. Come, spend the night in sackcloth, you who minister before my God. For the grain offerings and drink offerings are withheld from the house of your God. The priests are to mourn, they're to wail, but they're to do this Godwards. They're to do this before the altar. They're to do this because of the lack of worship in the house of God. And they have some structure to do this. They have some things to do. So they're to do so in sackcloth. And they're to do so all night long. They're to call a fast for the whole community in verse 14. Now you could say, well, wouldn't the prayers have been enough on their own? And certainly they would have been. But human beings are body and soul. And sometimes we need our body to do certain things to help us move our hearts in the right direction. So I guess most of us have been taught to close our eyes when we pray. You don't have to do that, do you? But the act of closing your eyes focuses you away from the world around you and towards God. Maybe some of you might kneel to remember that you're speaking to one who's above you, who's your Lord. At home, when nobody's around, I usually pray out loud so I don't get distracted by all my many thoughts. Sometimes we need those bodily steps, don't we, to help us. Well, they need to be reminded of the sorrow of the situation, and therefore they're to take those bodily actions. The sackcloth, every time it itches them, every time it feels uncomfortable, is to remind them of what's going on in their society. They're called to wear it all night, so presumably they're having some sort of all-night prayer meeting. Again, as they feel tired, they're to remember the pain of their community. And then a fast is called. Many of you will be familiar with fasting, and you'll know that as your tummy rumbles, you're about to rush down to the kitchen to get yourself a snack, and then you realize that you're not to do that, but you're called to pray instead. It's not just the priests who do this, but they're to declare a holy fast, verse 14, call a sacred assembly, summon the elders and all who live in the land to the house of the Lord your God, and cry out to the Lord. So the people come together, all of them gather, the leaders, the priests, and the people of God more generally. And in being together and forsaking food together, they're reminding each other to lift this situation to God. Now, there's numerous examples of group fasting in the Bible. You might think of Esther. You might think of some of the events of the Ezra and Nehemiah period. You might think of how Jesus fasted before his ministry, of how the apostles fasted before appointing elders. It seems that in particular times of focused prayer, fasting clarifies the mind, focuses on prayer. It can be a useful tool, and it certainly has been a good reminder to read this for me, to focus on that, both for us as a community and maybe for myself as an individual. I can think of times where I've been distracted about praying for the worst situation, someone I know and love who isn't a Christian. And my mind is so easily distracted from their pain. Maybe it would be better to set aside a period of time to remember by fasting the terrible situation they're in. Then, of course, when great events of suffering happen, that might be helpful too. Nevertheless, the Bible says time and time again that fasting in and of itself does not get extra heaven points. The heart does. The point is humbling yourself before God. And we see the heart at the end of verse 14, cry out to the Lord. And then we see it in verses 16 to 18 as well. Has not the food been cut off before our very eyes? Joy and gladness from the house of our God. The seeds are shriveled beneath the clods. The storehouses are in ruins. The granaries have been broken down. For the grain is dried up. How the cattle moan. The herds mill about because they have no pasture. Even the flocks of sheep are suffering. All of these prayers of laments, these complaints about the situation, followed by, to you, Lord, I call. And more laments. That's the focus. To you, Lord, I call. If there's a fire, There's no use calling your mum. There's no use calling the police even. You need to call the fire service. We all know that. And yet for many of us, we recognize that there's a problem only God can fix. Maybe it's a huge situation in our society. And maybe it's a spiritual situation in our society. A locust swarm of sin and godlessness that has swept our land. Whatever it is, we're not to moan about it to ourselves and think, what a regrettable situation. We're not just to speak to others and say, what a terrible event this is. No, we're to cry out to God. If we struggle to do that solo, maybe we should do it together. Maybe we should gather together, bring ourselves to the throne of grace. And as we are each doing this together, we're reminding ourselves to bring this situation, not to ourselves and our own anxious thoughts, not to our friends to gossip and complain about, to the Lord, the only one who can do something about it. Let suffering make you lament. Run to God in prayer. Many of you will know that famous phrase. Is it C.S. Lewis who says it? Suffering is God's megaphone. It's how God shouts to us when we're ignoring him. What is God saying in that megaphone? Well, we've seen two things tonight, and we'll see more as we go through Joel. He's saying that we should weep. We should have a godly sorrow for the way the world is. He's saying we should lament, that we should turn our eyes to him as the only one who can help us. There's more he's saying in the rest of the book, and we'll get to that in successive weeks. This is where we must start. What's your response to suffering? Whether it's personal, whether it's societal, whether it's spiritual. Is it to stuff your fingers in your ears and not listen to what God is shouting in those events? Or does it draw you to come back and cry to him again? Let's be like Joel and the people he encourages in this book. Let's weep in the face of suffering. Let's lament in the face of suffering. And as we cry out to God, we'll find that he gives us the strength to help in even the most difficult of times.